You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical, coming out on a semi-regular basis now.
It'll happen twice a month at some point.
At least twice a month. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm the senior editor. I'm here with...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
I'm Susie Evans. I'm the managing editor.
So we're deep into production for our May-June issue, the big double issue, international focus. Our April issue's here. I just got back from a trip to my home state of Arizona, where I didn't see a lot of... I saw some theater, some formative theater experiences when I was a kid. But while I was there, I talked to a couple of actress, director, producers who... are both from Michigan, I believe. They studied in Michigan. They did some time in New York, and now they're based in Phoenix. And they have decided, they got a small grant from the Arizona Arts Commission, I think I have the name right, to start a project on, you know, increasing awareness of gender disparity, increasing gender parity. In Arizona theater, which is, they looked at the statistics. It's the kind of same kind of dispiriting 17 to 20%, something like that. One in five or fewer, women in leadership positions in Arizona. And so they want to highlight that, and they're going to do a festival or conference in June, I believe it is. Anyway, that's the interview I bring back from Arizona, for this podcast.
We travel sometimes.
We do travel. This was not an official theater travel. And of course, I can't write off the trip for just one one interview.
Write off a lunch or something.
Believe me, I've tried. But no, it doesn't work. In any case, we're going to talk about... We're still in the midst of, while we're doing our May-June issue, writing season updates. Every theater in the country seems to be announcing their seasons between... A few, like a month ago, till who knows, when does this ever stop? Does this stop at some point?
No, it doesn't stop.
It doesn't stop.
Because some people have summer seasons, and some people have like just January to December seasons, and some people have September to...
But there must be a season, when we're going to get all the seasons.
Summer. I feel like summer is when everyone will stop.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So the season kind of goes from early winter to through spring. Anyway,
yeah, spring and summer,
there's some interesting stuff, and we're excited. You know, we haven't really covered the seasons with this much attention. We have our schedules in the magazine, of course, and we have our October season preview. But each season is getting presented to us as a news item now with the website, and so we're able to sort of get excited. Yale Rep has a very exciting season, very female-focused. Atlantic Theater, you were mentioning.
Yeah, there's a lot of great shows that I think we've all talked about loving that are coming to theaters for second runs or third runs this year. I was excited about Atlantic's because Rollin Jones and Jackson Gaye's These Paper Bullets and Billy Joe Armstrong, of course.
Yeah.
Riff on Much Ado About Nothing and kind of a Beatles-inspired take, which was at Yale Rep. Is coming to the Atlantic, I think.
And the Geffen.
And the Geffen after the Atlantic.
It's before. Really Geffen is first, and then...
Before the Atlantic.
Right, but I think this is all planned. I mean, when I spoke to them about it, they said they wanted to do one more, at least one more out-of-town production before they came to New York, and possibly to a theater uptown.
Yeah, well, Rollin and Jackson did the Jammer at Atlantic, I think, 2 years ago, and they did the Intelligence of Jenny Chow.
I think they did that together,
I think it was at the Atlantic, too.
Yeah, they go back a ways.
Yeah, no, it's great. And Deep and I both saw it when it was at Yale Rep, and it was really fun.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing how it's changed since we did have some quibbles.
We had minor quibbles, yeah. And hopefully they've made updates and added more songs.
Well, hopefully they added more songs and turned into a bona fide musical is the idea,
right? Yeah, the songs were the best part. And my feeling leaving that theater was there weren't enough songs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted more songs.
If they get Billy Joe to basically write an original musical for Broadway... That's what they've sort of seemed to be backing into.
Yeah, I mean, basically. All the songs were gorgeous, but they're only like four or five, and so they needed a few more. I mean, and also Harold Prince is returning to direct David Yazbek and Itamar Moses musical called The Band's
Great.
Visit, which is based on an old foreign film about an Egyptian police band stuck in the desert
in Israel.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It looks amazing.
Yeah.
Carol Churchill revival. new plays from Dominic Morisseau and Adam Rapp should be fun. I don't know. I was also really excited about the Hypocrite season. You had talked to Sean Graney, who's back as artistic director.
They're doing a lot of musicals. That seems to be one of their specialties now.
Yeah. When I talked to them about the Gilbert and Sullivan musicals, they talked a lot about how they didn't do musicals because they liked to use something that was in the public domain so that they could do their Hypocrites riff on it, which is why Gilbert and Sullivan worked so well. But it's fun that now they're doing American Idiot and... what's the other musical that they're doing?
Oh, gosh, there's another big one.
That's another big one.
It's not in front of me.
I can look it up.
What's interesting is aren't they commissioned to do Yeomen of the Guard somewhere not at their home theater?
OSF. Sean Graney is
commissioned. Oh, he's directing it there. Yeah, okay.
There's no Hypocrites.
Adding Machine.
The Adding Machine. Yeah.
Musical at the Hypocrites.
And they're also producing The Ruffians Burning Bluebeard, which was a favorite.
And they're bringing back All Our Tragic. It's going to be an annual ritual, apparently.
It's a really subscriber-friendly season. They're going to...
an annual ritual of seeing 12-hour plays about Greek tragedy.
Ian McKellen once said to me that there's a few roles in your career that are, like, totally creative, fulfilling, then you have to do a bit, what he called a bit of slog. In other words, flog your wares, go on tour, do your Richard III for the whole world. And so I'm not saying that the Hypocrites are doing that, but I feel like... they've consolidated their brand, and now they're like, you know.
They know, and they're doing all their Gilbert and Sullivan musicals, like all around the country, like Actors Theater.
Just bring it to New York, please.
I know, they've never brought it to New York.
Bring it to BAM, bring it to Ars Nova, bring it to...
it would be great at Ars Nova.
Wouldn't it? Yes. Yeah, Ars Nova, you know, someone with this interactive space. Or the Public, I suppose.
Yeah, the Public
Joe's
would even
Pub.
Be great for it.
Mm-hmm. I can't believe they haven't done that at Joe's Pub. Anyway, we're going off topic.
Yeah, Hypocrites, come to Joe's Pub.
One problem with being on this sort of news cycle that we are every day, I can't remember... the news from the day ago. So I just want to talk about that. There was one that came in today that was really pretty exciting. Actors Express, a small theater in Atlanta, has two world premieres by Steve Yockey, who's from Atlanta. And I think this is something we should write about. I'm just going to pitch it right now. This is an editorial meeting. Janine Neighbors, who's, I believe, New York-based.
Yeah.
Houston-born. She's writing a new play called Serial Blackface, three words. And it's set against the backdrop of those terrible child murders in Atlanta in 1979, the thing that Atlanta was known for, unfortunately, when I was a kid, I remember hearing about the 23 children were killed in Atlanta. Anyway, very exciting backdrop for a play. But what struck me was that their focus on their local, telling stories of their actual city. What a concept, you know, commissioning plays about.
Is this like the first, and I never heard of them doing any world premieres before this. Is this something new?
I couldn't say with any authority. They do, they're doing Josh Harmon's Significant Other, which is only going to premiere.
RTC.
Roundabout doing it?
Yeah, Roundabout's doing it.
Roundabout's doing it like it's next
commission.
Month.
Yeah.
And
next
so,
month?
Yeah, we have to
month.
Write about it.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And so then,
okay.
It's interesting that they did Bad Jews, Josh Harmon's last play at Actors Express in Atlanta, but they've snapped up his next play already. So I that's a season that just literally I just entered and it was interesting to me. So watch for that one. You were pointing out another one there, Deep.
Yeah,
with
your favorite your favorite place in the world, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah, yeah.
For like
well,
2016.
This season, is the one I'm really excited about with the Jeff Whitty Go-Go's musical. And a bunch of other things.
We got to look to 2016 now.
But 2016 has got a new play by Queen Nguyen. And what's it called? Viet Gone.
Viet Gone.
Right? His family story.
Yeah, he's been developing it for years. And it's based on the love story of his parents.
And they're doing Row, which is one of their history plays.
Yes. From Lisa Loomer is writing a play based on Roe versus Wade for
right,
the American
right.
history cycle.
And they're doing The Wiz.
It's controversial.
The Wiz yes. in the Elizabethan Theater, if I recall correctly, which is, you know, when I used to go there, the Elizabethan Theater literally was just Elizabethan work. And then they started to do Three Musketeers and Don Quixote and this year they're doing Head Over Heels, which is based loosely on Elizabethan text by Sir Philip Sidney. For them to do The Wiz outdoors, I mean, I welcome it, but that's just like they're just pushing the boundaries. They are doing more Shakespeare. This year they're only doing like two Shakespeares, I think. I could be wrong. Two or three Shakespeares at the Shakespeare Festival. Next year I think it's up to four or five.
Yeah, including A Winter's Tale set in China. from Desdemona Chang, so I don't.
Oh, but it's set in China and somewhere else, isn't it? Like,
yeah, and in the American West,
right? Because you know, The Winter's Tale is set in two totally crazily different places. You know,
it's one of those plays where I do not. Yeah, quite
and then
understand
how the season announcements are. April issue is hitting newsstands about now. I think subscribers should be getting it. So
it's a good
should
one.
We go through the highlights of our.
We can
April
mention
issue?
That we published Straight White Men, the Young Gene Lee play, and we have an essay about Straight White Men and other anti-realist plays like
I call a moratorium on covering Young Gene Lee for a while.
Sure.
No, it's a great, we did it, there's a great conversation between Larissa Fast Horse and Young Gene Lee with the publication, and then as Rob mentioned, Isaac Butler's essay about non-realist living room plays like Here by Taylor Mack, which we also published, and The Open House by Will Eno, and also Straight White Men.
Yeah, Appropriate by Brian Jacob Jenkins, you know, postmodern anti-realist. There's ironic living room plays.
And there's a giant critical essay by Roger Copeland about Chekhov, about how Chekhov is positing that Chekhov is the most contemporary of all playwrights, that he's art.
He's more so contemporary than Shakespeare.
I mean, riffing on the Jancott essay that's famous, Shakespeare, Our Contemporary, which is very influential. He's trying to make the case that Chekhov is our contemporary. He spends a lot of time saying, ooh, this is such a heretical idea. I think it's actually pretty mainstream that Chekhov's contemporary, but it's a fascinating read. There's a lot of plays he brings into the mix, including everything from Chekhov Lizard Brain to Peter Brook's work.
To the cover, Vanya and Sonia and Masha.
Yeah, so
and
Vanya,
Spike.
Sonia, Masha, and Spike, of course. And Wooster Group's Brace Up. I have to plump for one story that I really am happy that we did. These aren't always the stories that the publicist pitched to us. They aren't always the stories that seem the most interesting. But for our readership, I cannot recommend highly enough Chris Fire's Q&A with Rock Schulfer. It's just a meaty. If you go to the TCG conference and just love to hear people talk about how to run a theater, how to build a subscriber base, what the balance that you have to strike between art and commerce. Rock is one of the sharpest guys in the business, and it's just a fascinating. Fascinating interview.
Rock is the executive director of the Goodman Theater.
Did I not
Chicago.
Say that?
Yeah. Been there for
Rock
four
Schulfer.
Years.
Rock Schulfer. Yeah, Goodman Theater. Can't recommend it highly
money.
Enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's a smart guy.
Running that business out of theater longer than Bob Falls has been artistic director.
Well, and he's been running it longer than some people who work there have been alive. So
yeah.
He's
most of the people that work there have been alive.
And I think what's interesting to me also is that this idea that we sort of think of the Goodman as this like theater on the hill. It wasn't always. It almost went bankrupt several times. He started at the box office and worked his way up. So I think it's a fascinating interview. I'm glad we did it.
We don't get to the finance side of theater very often. So
no, we don't cover the nuts and bolts of from the managing to executive director side. I mean, Bob Falls is a fascinating artist. That would be an obvious story to do. And someone should do that story sometime.
Yeah, I wonder who great, should do that. What publication
great,
should do
about
that story?
Bob Falls, but I mean, I'm glad we did Rock. And it's also interesting because Chicago is such this famous theater scene, but it's known as a storefront theater. It's known for Steppenwolf. The Goodman is sort of almost taken for granted, but there's kind of like a bedrock theater, flagship theater there. So I'm happy with it. So, without further ado, I think we can go to our interview with Tracy Liz Miller and Brenda Jean Foley of the Bridge Initiative in Phoenix, Arizona.
So I happen to be here in Arizona on vacation, but taking a break from vacation to talk to Tracy Liz Miller and Brenda Jean Foley. About their new initiative, the Bridge Initiative, is that what it's called?
Okay.
Tell me about yourself, Tracy, who you are, what you do.
I just recently relocated to Arizona about almost 2 years ago.
Right.
I'm a freelance actor, director, producer. Mm-hmm. I'm associate producer of Vermont Shakespeare Company. I teach at the higher education level and a community college here.
Right.
And I act and direct as well, so I'm sort of in it all.
Right. And Brenda?
I'm a little bit the same. Sort of at this point in our career, we kind of have to be jack of all trades.
Mm-hmm.
So I am an actress, I'm a producer, I'm a writer, and just sort of trying to figure out what the Phoenix scene is, because as well as Tracy, I was an equity actress in New York for many years and have relocated within the last few years to Phoenix.
What is your sense, then, of having been here for a while, of what the scene's like? I know losing Actors Theater, Phoenix was a big blow.
It's a loaded question.
Yeah.
I mean, in one hand you could think, oh, that's discouraging. In another hand you could think, well, there's a lot of work or potential.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the pendulum will swing upward. We recently met Janet Arnold. She attended our first networking kickoff event for the Bridge Initiative. And she, for years, headed the Phoenix Jewish Theater.
And she founded it.
Closed 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she went through some dark times. She thought that was, you know, that's it.
Those
years of work. But now she showed up and she's ready to start infusing what she has with what we've started, which is exciting.
The question on the table here, and I think it's a national question, is, you know, what's the future of the theater?
Right.
You know, people are trying to figure out who the audience is and what to put in front of them.
Yeah.
It seems like from the outside, a lot of groups around here produce the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
They're catering to a certain audience, and there are little groups popping up here and there that are trying to change that.
Right.
And discover a new audience. And it's kind of part of our mission, too, is to sort of see, like, if we can reflect more what the community is on the stage.
Right.
Can we get more people in to see it?
Right.
And so that's, you know, one of the things we've been talking about.
Absolutely.
Well, that we could segue to the question of gender disparity, because the community in any community, even no matter how ethnically homogeneous or heterogeneous it might be, tends to be at least 50% women. theater ticket buying audience is often
more.
Different statistics
the
show
majority,
this
yeah.
a majority or most tend to be women. And that's not, would you say, I don't know if you've done formal analysis of what Arizona theaters look like or gender, and you're talking about gender parity in all departments, not just playwriting and directing.
In theory, that's the goal initially.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just trying to educate at this point to show that that is not in place.
Right.
Across the board, every discipline.
We looked at all of it. We looked at all of it, and we presented this at our Art Tank pitch, and it received gasps.
Where the audience were like,
really? This is really happening? And
so now tell me about that pitch. Backtrack a little bit.
Yeah, the pitch happened in January, and it was in the fall where Brenda and I and my partner Kent and Ryan started to spend more time, and our girls were, you know, hanging out, play dates. And we just struck up a conversation, and I said, well, what's going on here? What have you found here? And I said, well, I think there's a real problem with lack of women in leadership positions.
Right.
And Brenda's look on her face said, you're right. And we both, I said, well, how do you want to do this? So we...
Tracy figured out that this the Arizona Commission for the Arts offers these Art Tank grants, which you mentioned.
Okay.
And they're seed funding for basically new projects. So some existing companies will use them for a brand new idea.
Right.
Or people like us go, well, here's a brand new company that we're trying to launch with your money.
So we were
brand new. Our pitch was. We had applied for the grant, and then they select 10 finalists, and then you pitch to the community, and the community, vote on, like, an audience award, but basically there's, a panel of six experts, everybody from a state senator to, you know, arts people in the community that vote on 3 awardees to receive grant money.
So what was the pitch? Pull it down from there.
It was, we presented the current statistics, which are astounding to a lot of people. 1 in 4 of the leadership positions in theater arts program are women.
In Arizona.
And this is arts programs in general.
We focused on theater. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it mirrors pretty close in all the other disciplines.
So
1 in 4 leadership, and we use leadership meaning the managing directors or artistic directors or executive producers.
And for us, we were talking community theater, semi-professional and professional. We sort
all
of went
kinds.
Across the board.
Children's theater.
Right.
We also looked at those that have an influence on the programming, such as the directors or the playwrights. And we took us a while to narrow down who we were going to focus on. So we chose the top 3, so
for
to speak,
those
with budgets who produce in the state. So Arizona Theater Company, Phoenix Theater, and Southwest Shakespeare.
And those are the 3 who have equity contracts sort of like yearly.
And where does Southwest Shakespeare do this stuff? Do they do it here?
Mesa Art Center.
Mesa Art Center, okay.
And, you know, I understand that Shakespeare is male-driven.
I
produce Shakespeare. I teach Shakespeare. I love it.
Right, right.
but we used it as sort of the benchmark of who had equity contracts. And we didn't mean to not focus on the non-union professional
workers
here. But we needed to sort of narrow it down. And Arizona Theater Company definitely has the largest budget. And Phoenix Theater is pretty darn close.
Okay.
There was
19 productions.
19 productions.
Two female directors. And we gave them one female playwright because there was an adaptation by a female, and then second piece was co-written by a female. So we kind of gave half for
female.
So Annie Baker adapted Uncle Vanya by Shakespeare's producing it. So we kind of gave them a little credit.
And Sheer Madness is written by a man and a woman. So we're like, we'll give you half for each of those. So one out of the 19 we'll give
as
a female.
Yeah, when I've tried to count the TCG seasons by gender, mm-hmm. and I've had to do similar calculations, you know.
We'll give you a little bit of credit here.
Right. You know, some of the musicals have a female librettist.
But not in this case.
It just wasn't happening.
Yeah.
We
could have been even more damning if we added up the number of, you know, writers on, but we were just like, you know what, 19 productions, we'll give you one female writer.
So then your pitch to address that, how are you going to use a playwriting contest and a mentorship program? Is that
It's multi-tiered. I mean, first of all, we just need to educate. We need to educate at all levels. We need the audience to know. We need the producers to know. We need the community leaders to know. We need the press to know. And the artists as well. To be honest with you, a lot of artists who are existing in this community didn't even realize it. Even those who are producing, mm-hmm. even females who are producing.
Right.
We're
looking
alarmed
at their past seasons and going, wow, you're right, we haven't
so
been.
Right. And it is, I don't want to say that, you know, they're not bad people, they're not being conscientious. I think it's just a status quo and society imprinting that, you know, they feel pretty good that there's one big play in there that maybe is female driven and then they sort of think, oh, then we're doing something. And it's the same thing in the film world.
It's even worse.
So I think it's a multi-tiered education, just to get the word out there. And I think some things are starting to shift because of it, even before mm-hmm. we even produced our first symposium.
So the actual things that we're doing is we're trying to have networking events every quarter just to kind of identify each other. Like, okay, who are the female artists in the Valley?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be compiling a list so that if, you know, for example, a producing entity says, you know what, I don't have a female director on my season, and I don't even know where to find one, we'll have a list of here's some to call.
A list is a good,
So we're compiling that information, and then, you know, and sort of we're culminating it all in this symposium. We're calling it a symposium in June, a two-week period, which we're going to have some play readings, we're going to have master classes, and again, some networking opportunities and culminating.
Mm-hmm. You can get the conversation going. Yeah. Bring people into it.
And we're culminating it with producing this premiere of a play that we're currently, in the middle of reading through all the scripts that we've received for our contest. But we're going to award a playwright and director of the year and produce that play in June.
So the playwriting contest is already underway.
We received over 90 submissions.
And what are the parameters of the contest?
We opened it up nationally because we know that, again, unfortunately, historically, there hasn't been the infrastructure to support necessarily, the writing strength here.
Yeah, sure.
So
sure.
We wanted to, this first year, make sure that the piece that we produced is, you know, professional quality and caliber for us to work on.
Right.
So we've solicited nationally. We actually received international submissions, believe it or not. But we solicited nationally for playwrights, and we're going to be awarding a small cash prize and a travel stipend, and then the production. And then we're looking also for a local director to direct it.
Okay.
So,
but again, you know, the challenge is because the infrastructure hasn't been in place to develop these talents.
Right.
There's less available to us, and we're finding that the ones that do you know this woman, we contact them and they are booked, which is good,
right?
But there's only a few of them.
We're
trying to find ones that either emerging or perhaps and this is also part of our mission. There are, as theater artists, we all have to be multifaceted. We have to wear a lot of hats, and mm-hmm. and I think it is part of who we are as expressionist theater people that we, not only do we direct, we also act, or we also may produce. And those opportunities to learn those other skills, to maybe cross over into mm-hmm. the other disciplines, are really limited. There is
right.
very little mentorship. There's very little opportunity to be an associate artist. There are, mm-hmm. you know, in the valley. Associate
yeah,
artists,
yeah. Yeah, yeah,
there
yeah.
aren't any.
Right.
So, yeah, so we Phoenix Theater does have a little bit of internship, but yeah, it's limited. And yeah, so we're hoping, you know, part of our symposium is going to be this mentorship opportunity for, you know, some of the students to come and work with professionals and you know, we're going to pay people. Mm-hmm. That's part of setting aside our money for. And in terms of the parameters, we're producing out of a black box.
Okay.
It's a theater company that I've started to be associated with, Mesa Encore Theater. It's a community
Mesa
theater.
Mesa Encore Theater, okay,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
But they have a black box space, so we could get it for relatively low rent. Obviously, we're paying them for the space, too. But that way, that was a parameter in terms of the submissions, was that it needs to be something that we can produce
right.
a proper production of in a black box space. We don't
and
have
the deadline's already passed, I guess, right?
The deadline
yeah.
has passed,
okay.
unfortunately,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
But not the directors. We're still looking for directors.
But, but
you want someone local, obviously, as you said.
Yeah.
Local
yeah.
or someone who may be able to return. I mean,
sure,
as
sure.
Yeah. as yourself, you're a theater artist that operates elsewhere, but you have home base here.
Right, right.
And maybe there'd be someone else like that.
And
right.
ideally, I mean, we do have some momentum, and it seems like there's interest, so we'd like to make this an annual thing. So, you know, we'll see.
Were you at all, I'm sure you're aware of other efforts around the Lilly Awards and
Absolutely.
The Kilroy's list,
mm-hmm.
and the one of the ideas behind that, and this is true not just of gender parity issues, but also of all kinds of diversity, is that efforts that leaders need to be make conscious effort
mm-hmm.
to include that in their season, because I think there is there's sort of a default that happens
mm-hmm.
because theaters are still predominantly, even the ones that aren't run just by white men.
Of course.
That's the literature,
yep.
and that's where there's, you know.
But how often do you see the Children's Hour? I mean, when you talk about a classic play.
That's true.
You know, there
true.
Are plays written by women that people don't even think of.
They don't revive often, yeah.
Yeah, that you don't see.
But the Pulitzer Prize Committee is an example of the current, I mean, as current as you could be,
yeah.
the three nominees were female playwrights,
right,
and
right.
yet they weren't produced on Broadway.
No, that's true.
And the Women's Project in New York City I interned
yeah.
with, so I learned
okay.
a lot about sort of this ideas from them, and
yeah.
it gave me an opportunity that I would have never had.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we cited this in our pitch about how
okay.
other regions and cities are starting
mm-hmm.
to address this, and
right.
the Phoenix area needs to get on board.
Yeah, I mean, this is the sixth largest metropolitan area in the country, so we felt like it should be part of the conversation.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think Joy Meade's she's at the Center Theater Group and is one of the main Kilroy, has talked about unconscious bias. It's just,
exactly.
It's just part of how we, and you know, there's actually science that shows that people might just assume that the man knows somehow. Even women, they'd be acculturated to do that. Assume that there's more authority in the male voice, and that the women's plays are in a special category. You know, that kind of thinking needs to be broken. But one way to do that is as you're making the list, I think there's often the notion that there are no good Asian actors, or there are no women playwrights. Like, well, actually, they are, and they're out
Absolutely.
Here. And here's a list of them, and here's the database
exactly.
where they are.
And
right.
I keep coming back to this idea of any time you start isolating a group, then you feel like the others are being, alienated or
yeah,
something.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we're not anti-men.
Right, right,
we love
right.
men.
Right, right, right.
You know, so that the first time you say that, oh, we're, you know, a women's initiative, then suddenly there's these walls that go up. But I don't think that what's gone on, the status quo, has any malice to it. I don't think that anybody is trying to exclude women. I just think, as you said, there's this unconscious bias and there's this perception
right.
that, yeah, all of great work is written by men.
Right, right.
And also right. it is mm-hmm. tricky, because the truth of the matter is a lot of the producers here do a lot of musical theater, which, you know,
yeah, sure.
sells a lot of tickets. And when you look at the canon, the numbers certainly aren't 50-50 in terms of the writers in
no,
musical theater.
No.
But if you consciously go, you know what, I do want to try and program a woman, you're going to find some Janine Tesori. You're going to find a Carolyn Lee maybe from
right.
the 50s. You can
right.
find, you know, some Marcia Norman scripts,
Mary
you know,
Rogers,
Bridges.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Mary Rogers.
Yeah.
They do exist.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if the effort is made, and certainly, I mean, I know a lot of female writers now,
yes.
you know, so if people want to, as you said, make a conscious effort,
yeah, yeah.
I do think that there's something to be said for it, and it could be really exciting.
I wondered if, you know, I grew up in Arizona, as we talked about,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, musical theater, that's a kind of aesthetic conservatism, possibly, you could argue. Is there any kind of pushback you're getting from Arizona, because it has a reputation for being a fairly conservative place in general, to the idea of making a conscious effort for gender parity and all this?
Not yet, because we're still relatively new.
Right.
There may be, again, sort of people who just are choosing not to be part of the conversation
because
they don't want to be in it, which, you know, which could be the case.
Right.
But and to sort of assist people, we're going to try to make it as easy as possible for the established producing entities to come. We're going to offer them free tickets to our play.
Sure.
Please come. Mm-hmm. We would love for you to come. Please,
right.
please, please.
And let's partner in the future. So let's talk. You know, we don't want to be exclusionary. Again, we're just trying to, you know, open up a conversation.
Right, right.
I do think we discovered that it is a little bit of a sensitive issue around here. When we were looking to apply for the grant, we wanted to do some research. So we put out a survey that we were trying to circulate to as many female artists in the area as possible. And a lot of them wanted to remain anonymous. They were afraid to sort of step forward. And I don't know if they were afraid to be seen as, you know, rabble rousers or something.
I'm not sure what,
but there was definitely, you know, we've sort of we touched on a couple things. There was a lawsuit a few years back, and there's just things. There's gag orders.
Oh, okay.
There's kind of
history.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's some fear. And I think if there's fear, even if they don't say why, it's telling if they wish to remain anonymous.
So we felt like us as newcomers, we're kind of in a unique position to say, you know what? All that baggage does not belong to us. We're trying to move forward, and let's create a new day.
Right, right, right. Was it I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail. Was it a lawsuit about employment issues specifically, or harassment, or something? Or
it is. You know, it's a sensitive topic.
Okay, sure.
And we wish to support those that were a part of it
and have shared their stories.
And shared their stories.
Yeah, we're not allowed to really discuss.
Yeah. Okay.
But,
well, yeah. I won't go
there. But it does deal with discrimination.
It
and
does
and
deal with the issues we're trying to accomplish. And,
all right.
And I think that backlash and just sort of the trickle-down effect of that is still there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there have been some people who chose to be anonymous who expressed pay difference as being a big problem.
Okay, yeah, sure.
But they didn't want to say who they were.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So
that goes to the issues that are outside the theater, I mean, about difference in pay.
It's not only in our field.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I did an interview a few weeks back with the local NPR affiliate.
Yeah.
And, you know, he kept saying, like, oh, well, you know, you think about the arts and you think it's going to be all inclusive and, you know, this sort of happy community. Like, why is this happening in the arts, too? And I thought, well, because we're no different than the rest of society.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds as though it's less about the sort of, I mean, the perception of the coast is that Arizona is such a red state and so conservative, but there's just entrenched ways of being and doing in theater that are just, I mean, you could say that.
Exactly.
It's not about politics per se. It's just how people.
Absolutely.
Institutions
you can encounter
behave.
It
yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah,
in theater mirror society.
Yeah.
So we're, you know, one of our accolades is that we're trying to mirror the true society instead of what it is people are perceiving.
So that's
what we're going to try to bring to the forefront. So people go, oh, wait a minute, yeah, you're right, there are 50% women instead of 20, or dare I say 17, which was some of the statistics.
Wow.
We may get pushback, but we have yet to see it.
Right,
I think
that's
where we are.
Another way that critics might see a conscious effort to make change is they see it as a quota. Like, we want 50-50 by 2000, you know, 2020.
Right, or are they concerned about their own job?
Well, there's that,
like,
too.
There's certainly, obviously, it's all very sensitive for lots of reasons.
Sure.
But as I said, we're not trying to throw the book at anybody. We're just kind of trying to say, let's have a conversation about this and see if we can change moving forward and you know.
And artists are vulnerable enough as it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
We have, you know, it is an environment where there aren't a lot of people making a living just doing it.
Right.
Here, yeah,
and
for sure.
And so we're very conscious of the vulnerability of the artists.
Mm-hmm. Right. How do the plays look so far? Can you say anything about that?
Exciting.
Yeah, we have, oh my gosh,
across
the board. Yeah, we have everything from somebody whose play is essentially a poem. She's a poet, and she said, you know, I work on, you know,
very rhythmic and tone poem, and it's like essentially a, wow. You know, and we have an Indonesian playwright. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's incredible. We clearly have a lot of different races represented,
right.
A lot of different ages. We have one that, you know, is about. She had this whole thing about how you get wheelchairs because it's about wheelchair dancing. So okay. She had organizations to contact in order to, if you stage this play, here's who you should. I mean, it's
the excitement of the art. Yeah. It's not, in this point, it's not like just because they're women, they're going to write about women's plays.
Yeah, right.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have somebody writing about work, the space and many war plays, actually, believe it or not.
Really?
And a lot, you know, some that are sort of set in Jane Austen time. I mean, it spans the gamut. It's exciting, and you know, I think we're going to find something really, really neat and interesting to produce.
I think we might have difficulty narrowing it.
Oh yeah,
because we're both so excited to be involved in new work.
I know, right. That's the hard thing of going if we get 100 plays, 98 of them, we can, you know, we're going to read a couple. We're going to have a couple of reading, like the runners up. We'll read a couple,
and we're enlisting a lot of people to help us read through mm-hmm. these, because we want to have a wide range of voices. Digesting this large amount of work.
And also, I mean, there's a company in town called the Orange Theater that is doing very experimental kind of, I hate that word, but they do much less sort of narrative pieces and much more sort of
physical.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And so if we have, I think we might have a couple that would really be great with them, and Joya Scott, who's their artistic director and a woman director in town, we might pass them off to her. There are other opportunities that if it's not the right fit for us, we know people that, you know, we can highly recommend some of these pieces to if they're appropriate. So
just the last question I would ask is about what is the game plan going forward? There's the symposium in June.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a number of years this project goes on, and then how would you measure its success when it comes to like 50-50 everything?
I think, you know, to put us out of business would be a really exciting thing.
Yeah, really.
Right.
When and if that ever happens, would we be interested in continuing? Certainly, because I think just new work and development, it would be an mm-hmm. exciting thing to have in place here in the Valley. There's not much of that happening.
New work,
And whether we're gender disparity based or not, I don't think it would matter at mm-hmm. that point. Mm-hmm. I think that infusing a connection between the students' population, there's ASU and there's the Maricopa Community Colleges, which is a lot of theater departments, there's GCU's theater departments, to build this bridge of the student population into the professional world, because there is this really strange gap of 61% of theater degree earners are female, and then 17% go into directing, end up directing professionally, or end up
or in
leading
leadership, executive
right.
leadership.
So
right.
there's something that's happening in between there that we could address on all levels.
Right, right.
That could just be, you know, let's figure out what's happening with the student population, and they're jumping ship. They're going elsewhere.
Right.
I think also getting the educational institutes interested in what's happening professionally,
right.
and vice versa, so that. That we're infusing not only new talent, but an interest in what's happening outside of their doors, I think would be a wonderful thing.
Ideally, at a certain point, like we're trying to create professional work,
mm-hmm.
which requires money.
Right.
We received the seed funding this year. We're doing an Indiegogo right now to try and raise some extra to match it. So that we can really have a great launch. But certainly that'll be a factor going forward if we can get money.
So this is just a fund through June for one year, and then maybe.
Yeah, we'll be seeing what other grant funding and things we can accomplish.
We'll see. I mean, again, the state of the arts, we've just had a big wallop with budget cuts.
Yeah.
And that's a little, you know, and higher education and arts are probably are the ones that we're going
to
get.
So there were fresh budget cuts to the arts funds in Arizona this past
year. Really horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the Arizona Commission for the Arts, where we received our grant, I think they were cut by $1 million or something, which I can't even imagine.
I'm sure the Art Tank initiative, which was only in its second year, probably will.
It might be done. Yeah, it might. We might have been some of the last recipients, unfortunately. So we'll see. I mean, we'll see what the next steps are. But
not only was it funding, but it was also a celebration of new ideas
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
new concepts, and it was a real celebratory environment.
Oh,
it was
great.
When we produced, it was all these companies that came and their supporters
pitched,
and their and volunteers, and it was, people were applauding everyone's efforts. Mm-hmm. And I think that was so important for this community to have this, these new ideas coming in and getting press about it and getting interest. And so I think, sadly, it'll be a double-edged sword. It'll be funding and then buzz and focus on new ideas that will be cut.
But we feel already, like, regardless, we've accomplished a lot in terms of the conversation has begun.
Right.
Artistic directors have started to approach us to get names, and, you know, we are speaking to press.
Right.
So, you know, we'll see where we are 5 years from now or 3 years from now. So we're trying not to look too far into the future, but you know, we definitely feel like we're launching something.
And
so,
the Hormel Festival, which is a new works festival, they're half and half.
I don't know.
I would like to think that maybe they heard that we did this pitch in January and people talked about it. I don't know.
Okay.
I would like to think that. And then Phoenix Theater, so when is the new works festival, they've just announced it's all female works. So I'd like to think that they're
trying to get to yes or no. I mean, I think that was blind and that, you know, I think they the best stuff they got might have happened to have been written by women, God forbid.
Right.
You know, like, let's see who says that women can't write. So, that's actually this weekend and next weekend.
The Hormel Festival, okay.
Mm-hmm. So it is, I think there is going to be, whether we're able to continue on because of funding or not, the conversation has started and it's going to trickle.
And we're
going to
be part of it in whatever way.
Good things are happening in Arizona.
Yeah,
we hope so.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Tracy and Brenda.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Pleasure.
And we're back. We've solved gender parity in Arizona. So we do recommendations real quick, things that we've seen, read, thought about that want to tell you about. Dee, why don't you start?
Why am I only starting?
I don't know, because you're sitting right there.
Because I'm the person holding the computer. But anyhow, so I guess it's kind of a twofold recommendation. Well, it's for a play that's no longer running, but you can read it. It's a Susan Blackburn Prize 2015 nominee. So the other, a few weeks ago, I saw this play called The World of Extreme Happiness by a playwright, half Caucasian, half Taiwanese playwright, Frances Yatu Kaoig. I interviewed her in our February issue.
Yeah.
I don't know when I've written things. But anyhow, the play is about this girl this peasant girl who lives in China and how she moves to the city to get work, and then she works, and then she finds work in this kind of like Foxconn-like factory where people are jumping off of the buildings to kill themselves, that all fun stuff, and she's trying to get promotion from like janitor to like the manager of the janitors. So
right,
not very 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 humble dreams, and it's kind of about how she makes a devil's bargain and how she has to negotiate like her own ambitions with the fact that she lives in this system that's kind of that fosters inequality and kind of makes money off of that.
Right.
So it's a story that you probably heard in the headlines and, you know, in the New Yorker.
Right.
But the reason that it kind of affected me so much is because it's an underrepresented viewpoint and voice in the theater. I saw it at Manhattan Theater Club, and it was a co-production with the Goodman. But the thing that the reason I bring this up is because after I was done with it, I kind of noticed that this play that I saw and the plays that the critics saw was something completely different. Like, I thought it was powerful, and it kind of gutted me in a very primal way, just because it's something that affects me very closely. And somehow, like, I did not see that emotional reaction from the critics, the critical reviews I read. I didn't see it from the audience. And there was someone behind me, like, talking the entire time.
Love that.
And then I was listening to the Maximu podcast, which is a theater podcast of it's theater reviews and the like, and of New York based. And their March 18th episode, I should recommend because I'm recommending that. Because
they got it?
They got it.
Yeah, okay.
They got it, but they're also recommending that play. They're also recommending reviewing Brandon Jacob Jenkins's, you know, Octoroon, and also reviewing Heidi Chronicles, and they got into this really good conversation about, like, audiences and how, like, an audience can, like, sit through yet another play about slavery. Like, we have, like, two plays about slavery in this season alone, and people cannot get enough of slavery, but then you set them in a theater to make them hear a story about Chinese peasants, and then suddenly someone in the Maximum podcast said, oh, I talked to a playwright, and he said, oh, I'm so tired about these stories about Chinese peasants.
How many stories are about Chinese peasants? What are you talking about?
The only one I can sort of think of, and it doesn't even relate, is, what's his name, Mike Daisy, Steve Jobs.
Right.
It's sort of about the Foxconn factories, too. But it's from a totally different perspective.
Yeah, right. And it was 2 years ago, and yet we have so many... But, like, there's somehow this divide between if it's not, like, a story set on American soil in an apartment on the Upper West Side, like, somehow there's a break and audiences don't relate to it.
In the Old South is what you're saying, like, with American slavery. Or...
And you mentioned Heidi Chronicles in that Maximum podcast, which is actually what I want to recommend today, which is actually set in New York, a lot on the Upper West Side, in apartments, and people still can't relate to it because they're like, I'm tired of these, like, gender discussions, or I'm tired of these, like, this other outsider. And a lot of complaints I've heard about this production, which I don't agree with, is that people say it's dated. They're like, well, this is super dated. And it's certainly a period piece. It's certainly set in the 70s and 80s. Primarily.
How does it feel dated? I haven't read the criticism. What do they mean by dated?
I don't think it feels dated. I think it feels like a period piece, but I think the themes are very much relevant, and it spoke to me largely because it's something that I feel very passionately about. It's a play that means a lot to me. It's my first time seeing it produced. I thought Elizabeth Moss and Jason Biggs and Bryce Pinkham were all stunning in it. It's very clear in the production that it is set in the 70s time period. It's not trying to be a modern production. The clothes are 70s, the sets are 70s, everything is kind of put in that production. But this complaint that it's dated is that, I guess, these aren't trials of modern audiences. We don't relate to it. So I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
Women don't,
like,
have to, you know, deal with
the question is, can you have it all as a woman? Like, that is a question. There's also questions that, like, I mean, men can relate to that. I think men can relate to, there's a big scene about a gay character and his friends going through the AIDS crisis, like, very heartfelt stuff.
What's interesting is I saw, the only production I saw of Cloud Nine, you mentioned that, was about 10 years ago, and that's a play from the 80s, early 80s, late 70s, and that weirdly felt dated in a weird way. Like, it felt, but I'm fascinated to see it again, because it felt like a lot of those issues of gender and also colonialism that were part of Cloud Nine felt like, oh, we've seen that, or more like Carol Churchill had paved the way for so much of what we'd seen before that felt like, oh, this isn't that new, but it's she did it first, you know?
And I feel like Wendy Wasserstein is someone who did it first, and it also, there's a huge monologue in the second act of the play that's all about, it could have been written today if you just changed, like, the trendy clothes from purple leather jackets to, like, I don't know, 7 jeans or something. That the only thing that dated it was that she mentioned these clothing items of women's at the gym. And I was that she was at jazzercise instead of yoga or Pilates. Like, that was the only thing that dated it.
Right.
And so it's just interesting. I mean, one of the reviews I read from a dear friend, Adam Feldman at Time Out New York, called it non-urgent. And I was like, I don't understand
we're still fighting
why
these battles.
We're still fighting these exact same battles that are in this play. And sure, it's set in a specific time and period because that's what the play is. That's where the play lives. But the themes, as all theater, as Shakespeare, as anything, feel so relevant. So
I
love the Heidi Chronicles. Go see it.
What's interesting is, like, also is urgency the bar? Like, this isn't urgent. Is the fish in the dark urgent? But anyway, what were you gonna say?
No, my problem is the fact that you see these stories about, like, underrepresented voices, see stories about, like, Asian American characters or, like, black characters or, like, female, like, with female protagonists, and then people say, I'm so tired of all these stories about these women problems. And then I'm thinking, wait, but there are no stories about that. That's not the voices that's represented. Like, how is there too much?
And I'm like, Wendy Wasserstein, this play is one of two female playwrights on Broadway this entire season. One's Lisa D'Amore with Airline Highway, another great play. And the Heidi Chronicles. There's two.
Isn't Lisa D'Amore like the
first new play by a living female playwright in 2 years since Teresa Rebeck on Seminar?
Wow. Of course, it is commercial theater, so it's, you know.
It is, but, I mean, Wendy Wasserstein is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play directed by Pam MacKinnon, starring a huge TV star and theater star.
It's just like when we talk about holding producers to account, like in the nonprofit world. they have a public responsibility and they get tax breaks, and they really should be. Commercial producers is like whatever sells. It's good to put pressure on them.
But it was like produced in the 80s for the first time, and it won a Pulitzer, and now it's like 20 years later. It's not – the situation isn't better. It's still like one of very few plays that get that kind of like big national recognition.
And it's also – it's produced very commercially. I mean, Elizabeth Moss is phenomenal in it, right. But she's a huge star from Mad Men, which is entering its final season. Very buzzy right now. It's very commercially produced.
Well, what's interesting to me is we talk about women buy all the tickets. So what – why aren't there more women playwrights?
And it's also not selling very well as a play, which shocks me. I mean, I'm like, why? How is a big star in a great play not selling tickets?
Well, Mad Men's kind of like – Mad Men isn't one of those shows that appeals to like every single demographic.
She's also in the West Wing.
Of every age. I feel like it's one of those like art – like very chic shows for one very, very particular demographic of people, like very literate –
Right, like theater goers.
Yeah, exactly.
They should be selling. So
anyway, Rob, what do you recommend?
Well, I'll just tell you real quickly. I keep up the Facebook social media for American Theater and do a lot of the Twitter, too, with Deep's help. And I try to keep my tabs on all the things to read out there, right? The thing, the theater blowns, theater websites, HowlRound. TCG Circle is our own in-house blog that started before our website did. And they do good work. I have to say, this past week they did an Audience Revolution seminar in Kansas City. TCG hosted it. HowlRound live streamed it. I am still making my way through the most amazing, meaty, chunky, just like talk about that Rock Schulfer stuff where you're talking about how theaters make what they do relevant to people and make it matter and make people come back. This Audience Revolution series, there must be like 20 articles here. It's like a book. So I'm still making my way through some of them. Melissa Hillman's piece was amazing. Larissa Fasthorse has a piece in here. I'm still making my way through them all. Carrie Dodd has her own piece.
We should publish some on AmericanTheater.org.
We could do that. I mean,
or like curate the best of.
Lisa D'Amore and Katie Pearl have a piece about the Milton series, which we're very interested in.
Lisa D'Amore wrote a piece for TCG Circle.
Yeah, it's about how they did this series that play Milton.
Yeah, I know.
That's all these towns called Milton, just sort of arbitrarily chosen because they like the name, and they're doing this Milton series around the country. So. Anyway, I can't recommend it highly enough. There's a lot, though. It's I'm just telling you, I'm saving it to my little reader on my phone and trying to catch up with it my best I can. Oh, Joya Scott, another one from speaking of Phoenix. She runs a little theater there called the Orange Theater. She's going to direct one of the plays at the Bridge Initiative thing. And her piece was great about making theater matter in a place that might be seen of as a cultural desert. Anyway, I can't recommend this particular series of posts about Audience Revolution on TCG Circle more highly. So I think.
And we also have like the live stream from the Audience Revolution conference in Kansas City last week.
So yeah, it was on HowlRound. But yeah. Go to HowlRound. Their colleagues, their friends. We're glad they posted it.
To hear artists talk about how to engage audiences in new and exciting ways.
It was a lively discussion, which if you had it on your Twitter feed, it was going all through the weekend. Mm-hmm. And Thursday, Friday.
Hashtag OddRev.
Good of all the ones you should read on AmericanTheater.org.
We can do that for you. We can maybe, once we make it through them ourselves, we will try to curate them for you.
I think without further, once we get this podcast up, we'll do this other thing.
We'll do all this. Yeah, we'll do the other things we do. but thanks again for listening, and tune in next time.